A Time to Die by Wilbur Smith. She had sat for well over 2 hours without moving, and the need to do so was an almost unbearable affliction. Every muscle in her body seemed to quiver with a craving for movement. Her buttocks were numb, and despite being advised to do so, she had not emptied her bladder before they had gone into hiding, for she'd been embarrassed by the masculine company and still too nervous in the African bush to go off alone to find a private place. She regretted her modesty and her timidity now. She was staring out through the eye slit in the rude grass structure of the hide, down a narrow open tunnel that the gun-bearers had meticulously cleared through the thick bush, for even a tiny twig might deflect a bullet flying at 3,000 feet a second. The tunnel was 60 yards long, paced out so that the telescopic sight of the rifle could be zeroed on precisely. Without moving her head, Claudia swiveled her eyes towards where her father waited in the hide beside her. His rifle was propped in the V of a branch in front of him, and his right hand rested lightly on the stock. He needed to lift it mere inches to his cheek to be aiming and ready to fire. Even in her physical discomfort, the thought of her father firing that sinister, glistening weapon made her angry. Yet he had always filled her with violent and conflicting emotions. Nothing he ever did or said seemed to leave her untouched. He dominated her life, and she hated him and loved him for it. Always she was trying to break away, and always he drew her effortlessly back. She knew that the main reason that she was still unmarried at 26 years of age, despite the way she looked, despite her own singular achievements, despite having had countless proposals, at least two from men with whom she had believed herself in love at the time, the reason for all this was this man who sat beside her. She had never found another to compare with her papa. Colonel Ricardo Montero, soldier, engineer, scholar, gourmet, multimillionaire businessman, athlete, bon vivant, lady killer, sportsman. How many descriptions fitted him perfectly, and yet did not describe him as she knew him? They did not describe the kindness and the strength that made her love him, nor the cruelty, ruthlessness, which made her hate him. They did not describe what he had done to her mother that had turned her into a discarded alcoholic shell. Claudia knew he was as capable of destroying her if she let herself be run down by him. He was the bull and she the matador. He was a dangerous man, and therein lay most of his appeal. Someone had once told her, "Some women always fall for real bastards." She had immediately scoffed at the idea, but then thought about it later and came partially to accept it. The Lord knew Papa was one. A great, rambustious bastard, with all the charm and flashing golden brown eyes and shining teeth of his Latin origins. He could sing like Caruso and eat all the pasta she could heap on his plate. But although he had been born in Milano, the greater part of him was American, for Claudia's grandparents had emigrated to Seattle from Mussolini's Italy when Ricardo was a child. She'd inherited his physical characteristics, the eyes and teeth and glowing olive skin. But she tried to reject every value of his that offended her, and to take the opposite path to his. She had chosen to study law as a direct defiance of the lawless streak in him. And because he was a Republican, she had decided long before she could understand what politics meant, that she was a Democrat. Because he set so much store by wealth and possessions, Claudia had deliberately turned down the $200,000 job she was offered after graduating fifth in her law class, and had taken instead one at $40,000 in the Civil Rights Agency. Because Papa had commanded a battalion of engineers in Vietnam and still talked of gooks, her work with the indigenous Inuit people of Alaska gave her satisfaction, enhanced by his disapproval. He called the Eskimos gooks as well. Yet here she was in Africa, at his request, and the true horror of it was that he was here to kill animals and that she was in collusion with him. At home, what spare time she had was devoted to working without remuneration for the Alaskan Nature and Wildlife Conservation Society. The society devoted most of its resources and efforts to fighting the oil exploration companies and their depredations on the environment. Her father's company, Anchorage Tool and Engineering, was a major supplier of hardware to the drilling rigs and pipeline contractors. The choices she had made had been calculated and deliberate. Yet here she was in a foreign land, waiting submissively for him to assassinate some beautiful wild animal. Her own duplicity sickened her. They called this expedition a safari. She would never have even contemplated becoming an accomplice in such a heinous enterprise. In fact, she had indignantly refused the invitations he had made to her in previous years, but for the secret she had learnt a scant few days before her father had invited her. This might be the last time, the very last time, she would be alone with him. That thought appalled her more even than the dirty business in which they were engaged. "Oh, God," she thought, "what will I do without him? What will my world be without him?" As the thought struck her, she turned her head, her first movement in 2 hours, and looked over her shoulder. Another man sat close behind her in the small thatch-walled hide. He was the professional hunter. Although her father had hunted with this man on a dozen other safaris, Claudia had met him for the first time only 4 days previously, when they had disembarked from the South African Airways commercial flight at Harare, the capital city of Zimbabwe. The hunter had flown them out from there in his twin-engine Beechcraft Baron to this vast and remote hunting concession near the Mozambique border, which he chartered from the Zimbabwe government. His name was Sean Courtney. She had known him 4 days, but already she loathed him as if she had known him a lifetime. Not strange that thinking of her father had led her instinctively to look back at him. Here was another dangerous man, hard, ruthless, and so devilishly good-looking that her every instinct shrieked a warning against him. He frowned sharply at her with clear, bright green eyes in the darkly tanned face, and the crow's feet at the corners of his eyes puckered with annoyance at her movement. He touched her on the hip with one finger, cautioning her to stillness again. The touch was light, but she felt the disconcerting male strength in his single finger. She had noticed his hands before, trying not to be impressed by their graceful form. "The hands of an artist, or a surgeon, or a killer," she had thought then. But now that peremptory touch offended her. She felt as though she had been sexually violated. She stared fixedly ahead again, through the eye slit in the grass wall, and she fumed with indignation. How dare he touch her? The spot on her hip burned, as though he had branded her with his finger. That afternoon, before they'd left the camp, Sean had insisted that each of them shower and bathe with special unscented soap that he provided. He had cautioned Claudia to use no perfume, and one of the camp servants had laid out freshly washed an iron khaki shirt and slacks on her cot in the tent when she returned from the shower. "Those big cats can smell you from 2 miles downwind," Sean had told her. Yet now, after 2 hours in the heat of the Zambezi Valley, she could faintly smell him sitting up close behind her, almost but not quite touching her. Fresh male sweat, and she felt an almost irresistible urge to move in the canvas camp chair. He made her feel restless, but she forced herself to sit perfectly still. She found herself breathing deeply, trying to pick up the faint, intermittent wafts of his odour, then stopped herself angrily as soon as she realised what she was doing. Inches in front of her eyes, a single green leaf hanging down into the opening in the grass wall spiraled slowly on its stalk like a weathercock and almost immediately she felt the shift of the light evening breeze. Shaun had sighted the blind below the prevailing wind, and now, as the breeze came down to them, it brought a new odour, the stench of the carcass. The bait was an old buffalo cow. Shaun had selected her from a herd of 200 of the huge black animals. "That old girl is way past breeding," he had pointed her out. "Take her low on the shoulder, through the heart," he'd ordered Papa. It was the first animal Claudia had ever seen killed deliberately. The crash of the heavy rifle had shocked her, but not as deeply as the scarlet gush of blood in the bright African sunlight and the mournful death bellow of the old cow. She had walked back to where they had left the open Toyota hunting car and sat alone in the front seat in a cold sweat of nausea while Shaun and his trackers had butchered the carcass. They had hauled the carcass up into the lower branches of the wild fig tree with a power winch on the front of the Toyota, positioning it, with much debate between Shaun and his trackers, at the exact height which would enable a full-grown lion standing on his back legs to reach up and partially satisfy his hunger without enabling a large pride of cats to consume all of it at a sitting and so move on to find other fare. That had been 4 days previously. But even then, as they worked, the metallic green blowflies had come swarming to the smell of fresh blood. Now the heat and the flies had done their work. Claudia wrinkled her nose and grimaced at the stench that came down to her on the breeze. The smell seemed to coat her tongue and the back of her throat like slime, and staring at the carcass in the tree, she imagined she could see the black hide undulating softly as the maggots seethed and burrowed into the putrid flesh beneath it. "Lovely." Shaun had sniffed it before they entered the hide. "Just like a ripe camembert. No cat within 10 miles will be able to resist it." While they waited, the sun sagged wearily down the sky, and the colours of the bush now glowed with a richer light in contrast to the washed-out glare of noon. The faint coolness in the evening breeze seemed to awaken the wild birds from their heat-drugged stupor. In the undergrowth, down on the banks of the stream, a lowry called, "Cook, cook, cook," as raucously as a parrot. And in the branches directly over their heads, a pair of glistening metallic sunbirds flitted busily, with fluttering wings, hanging upside down from the fluffy blooms to suck up the nectar. Claudia lifted her head slowly to watch them with intense pleasure. Though she was so close that she could see their thin, tubular tongues thrusting deeply into the yellow flowers, the little creatures ignored her as though she was part of the tree. She was still watching the birds when she became aware of a sudden tension in the hide. Her father had stiffened, his hand on the buttstock of the rival clenched slightly. His sense of excitement was almost palpable. He was staring through his peephole, but though she stared as hard, she could not see what had excited him. From the corner of her eye, she saw Shaun Courtney reach forward between them, his hand moving with infinite stealth, to grasp her father's elbow in a cautionary, restraining grip. Then she heard Shaun's whisper, softer than the breeze. "Wait," he said. So they waited, deathly still, as the minutes drew out slowly and became 10, and then 20. "On the left," Shaun said, and it was so unexpected that she started at the barely audible murmur. Her eye swiveled left. She saw nothing, just grass and a bush and shadows. She stared unblinkingly until her eyes smarted and swam with tears, and she had to blink rapidly and then look again. And this time she saw something move like a mist or smoke, a drift of brown in the long sun-seared grass.